Shall we start? And you can hear me too?
Yep. Good. Well, it's Orlando today, as you may have guessed from my rather garish jacket. And here is one of Vita Sackville West's ancestors from Knowle, from the Knowle collection, on the screen. It's Orlando as a Boy, she subtitles it, the Honourable Edward Sackville from the Two Sons of Edward IV, Earl of Dorset, by Cornelius Nui, I think it says, in Lord Sackville's private apartments, Knowle. And as you may know, the house that this book is set in is really Knowle. 5 months after publishing her fifth, and many would say her greatest novel, To the Lighthouse, Virginia Woolf wrote to her friend and sometime lover, Vita Sackville West, on the 9th of October, 1927. Yesterday morning, I was in despair. You know that bloody book which Davy was helping with the Hogarth Press, which Davy and Leonard extort drop by drop from my breast. Fiction, or some title to that effect, it was called Phases of Fiction. I couldn't screw a word from me, and at last dropped my head in my hands, dipped my pen in the ink, and wrote these words as if automatically on a clean sheet, Orlando, a biography, and no phones, please. So every morning I'm going to write fiction, my own fiction, till 12, and romance till 1. But listen, suppose Orlando turns out to be Vita, and it's all about you and the lusts of your flesh and the lure of your mind. Heart, you have none, who go gallivanting down the lanes with your other lover, Campbell. Suppose there's the kind of shimmer of reality which sometimes attaches to my people as the luster on an oyster shell. Suppose I say that Sybil, that's Lady Sybil Colfax, Sybil, next October, says, there's Virginia, gone and written a book about Vita. Shall you mind? Say yes or no. Your excellence as a subject arises largely from your noble birth. But what's 400 years of nobility all the same? And the opportunity thus given for florid descriptive passages in great abundance. Also, I admit I should like to untwine and to twist again some very odd incongruous strands in you, going at length into the question of Campbell. This is Mary Campbell, the other lover. And also, as I told you, it sprung upon me how I could revolutionize biography in a night. And so, if agreeable to you, I should like to toss this up in the air and see what happens. Yes, of course, I may not write another line. Then in her diary entry for the same day, and the day is the 9th of October, 1927, she explained that it would be, quote, a biography beginning in the year 1500 and continuing to the present day, called Orlando. Vita, only with a change about from one sex to the other. As though this happens every day. Despite Virginia's well-known protest, my God, how does one write a biography? Her interest in the form started long before she made the remark in the late 1930s. She had already had several attempts at what she called life writing by the time Orlando was conceived. Biography ran in the family, of course. Her grandfather, Sir James Stephen, had been the author of 2 volumes of essays in ecclesiastical biography. That's 1849, and her father, Sir Leslie Stephen, a very formidable figure, was the author of that monumental dictionary of national biography. 68 volumes of it. I think Virginia felt she was one of the volumes in the end. Virginia herself was particularly interested in the lives of women. By the time she wrote to Vita in 1927 about her plans to revolutionize biography, she had already experimented with various ways of describing women's lives, including her comic lives of her 2 maiden aunts. I'd love to read those. Unfortunately, I think she either suppressed them or somebody destroyed them. They must have been so wicked. You know how wicked her sense of humor is by now. In the collection of essays she published 2 years before she conceived Orlando, this is the Common Reader, she'd already written about women at length. She had essays on the Duchess of Newcastle, you know how she loves nobility, Jane Austen, George Eliot, Miss Mitford, Dorothy Neville, and most intriguingly of all, I find, probably just because of the name, Miss Letitia Pilkington. And Miss Letitia Pilkington, appropriately enough, comes in an essay called Lives of the Obscure. With a name like that, how could you be obscure? Virginia was equally fascinated by women's relations to each other, what she calls women's love, as the five novels she completed by 1927 show. In her first book, The Voyage Out, the central relationship between women is between Rachel Ambrose, who is without her mother has died, and the older woman, Mrs. Ambrose. Sorry, Rachel Vinrace and Helen Ambrose. And in Virginia's own life, you probably know her mother died at 13. In this book, the relationship is reversed. And Rachel Vinrace, don't want to spoil it for you, but I am, Rachel Vinrace in The Voyage Out dies young, leaving the mother figure devastated. In Night and Day, which is in 1919, running parallel with Catherine Hillbury's very comical at times attempt to find a suitable husband, not one who is suitable financially, but one who is going to be the kind of person she can get on with, and he turns out to have no money at all, of course. And in this particular thing, she is very much involved with the women in her life as well. She's involved with Mary Datchet, who herself is yearning to marry the man Catherine eventually decides is a suitable husband, someone based on Leonard Woolfe, Ralph. And though Jacob's Room in 1922 takes, rather unusually, a hero for its, or a man for its main character, the relationships of his women adorers, and I think he's rather unfaithful to all of them, so none of them really get Jacob in the end. The war takes him in the end. But the relationship between Florinda what are the names of these people? Clara, Fanny, and his last married lover, Mrs. Medworth Williams, their lives are explored in almost as much detail, perhaps sometimes more detail, than the life of her so-called hero, Jacob. Of course, yesterday I told you that in that book, it's the room that holds it together. Let us suppose, she says, that the room holds it together. In Mrs. Dalloway, published in 1924, 2 years after she met Vita, Virginia describes two very intense relationships between women. Though the word lesbianism is never used, it has been hailed. One reason why the English finally recognized Virginia Woolf was because American feminists decided that Virginia Woolf knew all about women's relationships. And Clarissa's youthful infatuation with Sally Seton coming down in white. And this wonderful sense of being in love, but being in love with a woman was very daring for the time, of course. And Miss Kilman, the governess's hopeless passion for Clarissa's daughter, who is beautiful but very reserved, Elizabeth Dalloway. To the Lighthouse, published in 1927, when Virginia herself was already beginning to have reservations about Vita and was just about to conceive Orlando, the relationship between the two female characters is a very complex one. Lily Briscoe, the painter, the artist in paint, is more or less in love with Mrs. Ramsay, the artist in life, the woman who has 8 children, as Virginia's mother did, although not, she didn't have them genetically, but she had 8 children to look after. And the relationship between these two women is very complicated and very interesting. Lily's in love, but resisting the mother figure, Mrs. Ramsay. I'm not for a moment suggesting that we should call Woolf a biographer rather than a novelist, but it is remarkable how much biographical material she uses. Jacob's Room, for example, could be said to be all about her brother who died young, Toby, because Jacob dies in the end in the war. But it's remarkable how much biographical and autobiographical material she uses in her so-called fiction. Hermione Lee, who's a brilliant biographer in my opinion, Hermione Lee argues that fiction is often Virginia Woolf's version of biography, and that Orlando, she argues, makes an explicit game out of this relationship. Orlando is the hero who turns into a heroine in a biography which turns out to be fiction. Wish I were that clever. Then adds, for Virginia, a revolution in biography is also a sexual revolution. Into the Lighthouse, Virginia's biographical interests are particularly clear. She describes this story of Mr. and Mrs. Ramsay and their family as father and mother done complete. She felt she could get over her parents. You know how one has to get over one's parents. She felt she could get over them when she'd written them into her novel. And maybe that was what she was doing with Vita, getting over the relationship. And in a similar way, Orlando, despite its outrageous plot, which regularly subverts notions of time and gender, can be seen to parallel Vita's life at many points. So it is really extremely biographical in a curious way. But before looking at some of these together, with the way together with the way Virginia makes them serve her purpose, I need to tell you just a little bit more about Vita and Virginia, just in case you don't already know it. Most people do. Virginia first met Vita, the daughter of Lord Sackville of Knowle, through Clive Bell, who shared his sister-in-law's fascination with the aristocracy. They were both what we would call good old-fashioned snobs. After dinner with Vita and her diplomat husband, Harold Nicholson, at the end of 1922, Virginia met her with increasing frequency in 1923 and 1924. It was not until 1925, however, when Vita was due to visit Harold, who'd gone to Persia. Vita had refused to go with him, but was visiting him, that she realized how strongly she felt about what she called her lovely aristocrat. Unlike Catherine Mansfield, another writer with whom she was fairly much in rivalry, she did not admire Vita for her writing. Do you remember that wonderful comment she made about Vita's writing? That she writes with a pen of brass? And it was very unkind of her, because in fact Vita probably earned more for the Hogarth Press when she published a book with them than Virginia had done to that point. But there was no rivalry in the sense that Virginia really didn't aspire to write as Vita did. Virginia freely admitted to her own snobbishness, and it was first and foremost Vita's aristocracy that appealed to her. Vita herself, with inverted snobbery, of course, loved to emphasize her humble origins. You know how aristocrats do? Oh, well, you know, one of my grandmothers was a Spanish dancer, she'd say. Even Vita's appearance seemed to Virginia to reflect her privileged background. There's this lovely passage where she describes Vita. I like her and being with her and the splendor. She shines in the grocer's shop in Seven Oaks with candle-lit radiance, stalking on legs like birch trees, pink, glowing, grape-clustered, pearl-hung. I couldn't quite bring off the Vita effect, I didn't think. So I opted for Orlando instead. And I love this passage because the editor doesn't know whether it's birch trees or beech trees. Do you think I've chosen the right one? I mean, legs like beech trees might be rather stout. Virginia loved Vita's romantic strain, which thrived at her ancestral home, Knowle. Its ancient buildings, vast parklands, and its nightingales. More than that, and I think you get all of that in Orlando, more than that, she found Vita what she felt she could never be herself, a real woman. I've always wondered what a real woman was. I still don't feel like a real woman, and as you know, I've had too many children. So, I mean, how do you get to be a real woman? I think you have to have a large bosom, I've decided. I could always get a breast enhancement, then I'd be a real woman. She thought her sister was a real woman. And it's interesting, isn't it, what she thinks is a real, she's very attracted to a real woman. Though she did feel that she was rather cold to her two children, Vita had a strange relationship, which I'll tell you about. And she was very close to Virginia and to Vita, and called her in that way she did when she wanted to be protected, wanted to be mothered by that mother who died at 13, she says, being cod Freudian. She said that she wanted to be her Potto, her African-like lemur. And she always used these nicknames if she wanted to feel protected in the relationship. Mongoose and Mandrill for Leonard and Virginia, and Goat for her daughter, her sister. She called Vita an insect. I don't know why that would have... I don't see the connection at all. Vita, as you'll see, is anything but an insect. Such a humble creature, which Vita was not. One strong contrast Virginia found with herself was her physical passion, especially for women. She loved the story of Vita with her cousin, who was Violet Trefusis, another aristocrat. His mother, I believe, had been the lover of King, I always forget my kings, one of the kings. And she really was very admiring of the impetuousness with which Vita had eloped with Violet Trefusis, with the husbands in hot pursuit across Europe. It's a lovely story. You can see why the book itself has so much humour in it. It's a lovely, funny story as well. But Violet and Vita really did have a very intense relationship, which I think Virginia, in a way, envied. Adorable, dusky, tortured, passionate, she talks about her being. Yet when Vita made the first physical advances, which she undoubtedly did, Virginia retreated, and Virginia retreated, and Vita called her a fish, cold as a fish. The main appeal, I mean, she did eventually respond physically, and of course everybody bought the book, or the letters between them make it quite clear that they did have a physical relationship. Though that didn't matter to Virginia, because for her the main thing was the intimacy with another person. She was as much in love with Leonard and as she was with Vita at one point, and the physical did not matter to her as much. It was the festival and the firelight, she said, that she wanted, rather than the lovemaking that entranced her. The main appeal in the relationship was the sense that someone was close to you intellectually or emotionally. In moments of disillusion, when Vita accused Virginia of using her as copy, Virginia accused her aristocrat of lacking vibration. She didn't feel she resonated in the way that she needed, and both were to some extent right. Even while their friendship with Vita was at its height, from 1925 to 1927, Virginia was indeed making copy of her relationship with Vita, which of course eventually comes out as Orlando, and Vita's ambiguous sexuality, which I don't have to point out to you. It comes out very clearly in the novel, in a very obvious way, as Orlando changes sex. It was not so much, as Vita argued, that Virginia approached people through her brain rather than her heart, but that her heart lay in her writing, and she couldn't really enjoy the physical in the same way. Vita is a pronounced sapphist, Virginia had written on the 19th of February, 1923, that lovely old-fashioned word for lesbian, less than 2 months after their first meeting. And therein lay one of her major problems in writing about Vita. She felt, and possibly advised by her much wiser husband, Leonard, that she couldn't really risk describing lesbianism openly in her book, though she did retain covert references to it. Her caution was justified, for even as she was writing Orlando, there was a trial going on of Radcliffe Hall's book, The Well of Loneliness, which was about a lesbian relationship. It's frankly a lesbian novel. Virginia herself was to judge this work a meritorious, dull book. But she admired the way in which she had tried to be frank in it. but agreed to appear with Leonard with what was called as an expert witness. They had 40 expert witnesses who were going to testify to the merit of the book. But the judge wasn't having any of it. And he said, well, no, you may be an expert in literature, but you're not an expert in obscenity. Go away. And of course decided against the book, which was banned. It wasn't deemed suitable material for literature, which I think is what Virginia faced as a problem. How could she write about it? Simple, change her sex. But if Virginia, she can have a relationship with a man, if she's a woman, and she can have a relationship with a woman if she's a man, right? It's very simple. But if Virginia could not fully explore her lesbianism, there were other sides to her she found equally fascinating. In the same diary passage describing her as a sapist, she also wrote, "Snob as I am, I trace her passions 500 years back, and they become romantic to me, like old yellow wine." And therein lay her answer to the problem. She could set her life of Vita at approximately the same time as her family, the Sackvilles, became aristocrats. They became aristocrats with the gift of Noel, this great estate, from their kinswoman, Elizabeth I. And that's where the book opens, when Queen Elizabeth visits Noel and grants the property to them. When Vita gave Virginia a tour of Noel in January 1927, one of the inspirations, I believe, for its title role, its character role, really, in Orlando, she also presented her with a copy of its history, Noel and the Sackvilles, which was a revised edition of 1926, which meant that Virginia was able to dip into this for different details, and I won't go into them, they wouldn't interest you. But I do like the diary passage where she says, "Vita took me over the 4 acres of building, which she loves. Too little conscious beauty for my taste, smallish rooms, looking onto buildings, no views. Yet one or two things remain. Vita stalking in her Turkish dress, attended by small boys down galleries, wafting them on like some tall sailing ship, a sort of covey of noble English life. Dogs walloping, children crowding, all very fine and stately. Cart bringing wood in to be sawn by the great circular saw. How do you see that?" I asked Vita. She said she saw it as something that had gone on for hundreds of years. They had brought wood in from the park to replenish the great fires like this for centuries. And her ancestresses had walked so on the snow with their great dogs bounding by them. All the centuries seem lit up, the past expressive, articulate, not dumb and forgotten. But a crowd of people stood behind, not dead at all, not remarkable, fair-faced, long-limbed, affable, and so we reach the days of Elizabeth's time quite easily. After tea, and this is important, this bit, because I think it also shows why she pushes the story through the centuries. After tea, looking for letters of Dryden's to show me, she tumbled out a love letter of Lord Dorset, 17th century, with a lock of his soft gold-tinted hair, which I held up in my hand. One had a sense of lynx fished up into the light, which usually submerged. Otherwise, no particular awe or any great sense of difference or distinction. They are not a brilliant race. The space and comeliness of it all struck me. I came home to Marjorie Strachey, Tom Elliot, T.S. Elliot, and Nessa, her sister, and Roger. So in other words, she came home to a very ordinary little gathering in Bloomsbury, which of course made her think how very splendid Noel had been. A little constricted our society, no talk of the clergy or of the country, but how lively and agile compared with Noel, she said. And that's her diary for the 23rd of January, 1927. Orlando was to be the imaginary life then of Vita, incorporating details of her real life, her ancestors' lives, and of Noel itself. as Virginia had seen it in deep snow at the beginning of 1927. Orlando's longevity would, among other things, represent the continuity. Do you get this sense when you're in England, the continuity of English aristocratic life? Aristocratic because, of course, the aristocrats were able to keep on in the same place and preserve things and add things, making the great baronial house a constant in her mad rush through the centuries. And Orlando's changes of sex enables Virginia to pull it all together. It would have been very difficult, I think, to have any sense of continuity if she had not, first of all, established the house as a character. You notice how Orlando comes back repeatedly to Noel, which is not named in the novel, but how as a woman in real life, she couldn't inherit it because of this law of primogeniture. In the novel, she does. So in a sense, Virginia is correcting the injustice in her novel. And by turning Orlando into a fantasy, I hope you enjoyed the fantasy. I didn't the first time round, I did the second. It made me laugh a great deal the second time round. A kind of modern day Arabian Nights, which anticipates the magic realism, of course, of writers like Angela Carter and Marquez. Wolf is able, paradoxically, to get nearer to the essential reality of Vita's life. Even in the opening section, for example, though the setting is Elizabethan and Orlando's sex is masculine, some essential characteristics and concerns of Vita and of her family are brilliantly conveyed. I like what Julia Briggs says. Julia Briggs is a brilliant critic of Virginia Woolf. She says, Orlando treats time rather as it treats sex, as if both were convenient fictions. The novel opens with the 16-year-old Orlando, and you have him here, represented by one of Vita's own ancestors from her own home. Orlando is slicing at the head of a moor, which swung from the rafters, and this is a clear allusion to Orlando, i.e. Vita's crusading ancestors, and their unself-conscious racism, which makes most modern readers more than a little uncomfortable. Having read Noel and the Sackvilles very carefully, Virginia freely borrowed from it names for servants, names for ancestors, and other details. The visit of Queen Elizabeth, for example, to the family. But the tour de force that follows, Orlando's visit with the royal court to the frozen Thames, which is an extraordinary scene, is more typical of her methods in general in the book. That is, in the way it mixes fiction, the fact, and in doing so, creates memorable literature. And I want you to turn to extract 3. This is when Orlando is on the ice. He's a little bit older now. We have to assume that he's a little bit older than 16 now, but he's a little bit older and he's looking. He has already been betrothed to the Lady Euphrosyne, but he's obviously not interested in the Lady Euphrosyne. Orlando, it is true. Have you got it? Extract 3. The first paragraph down. Sorry about that. Is it on page 2? Don't worry too much if you can't find it. Orlando, it is true, was none of those who tread lightly the Coranto and La Volta, those foreign silly measures. He was clumsy and a little absent-minded, as apparently Vita was. He much preferred the plain dances of his own country, which he had danced as a child, to these fantastic foreign measures. He had indeed just brought his feet together about 6 in the evening, of the 7th of January, at the finish of some quadrille or minuet, when he beheld, coming from the pavilion of the Muscovite embassy, a figure which, whether boys or woman's, for the loose tunic and trousers of the Russian fashion served to disguise the sex, filled him with the highest curiosity. The person, whatever the name or sex, was about middle height, very slenderly fashioned, and dressed entirely in oyster-coloured velvet. Sorry, I couldn't do the oyster-coloured velvet. Trimmed with some unfamiliar greenish-coloured fur. How exotic this person is. But these details were obscured by the extraordinary seductiveness which issued from the whole person. Images, metaphors of the most extreme and extravagant, twined and twisted in his mind. He called her a melon, a pineapple, an olive tree, an emerald, and a fox in the snow, all in a space of 3 seconds. He did not know whether he had heard her, tasted her, seen her, or all three together. For though we must pause not a moment in the narrative, we may here hastily note that all his images at this time were simple in the extreme to match his senses and were mostly taken from things he had liked the taste of as a boy. But if his senses were simple, they were at the same time extremely strong. To pause, therefore, and seek the reasons of things is out of the question, which he's just done, of course. A melon, an emerald, a fox in the snow. So he raved, so he stared. When the boy, for alas, a boy it must be, no woman could skate with such speed and vigour, swept almost on tiptoe past him, Orlando was ready to tear his hair with vexation that the person was of his own sex, and thus all embraces were out of the question. But the skater came closer. Legs, hands, carriage were boys, but no boy ever had a mouth like that. No boy had those breasts. No boy had eyes which looked as if they had been fished from the bottom of the sea. Finally coming to a stop and sweeping a curtsy with the utmost grace to the king, who was shuffling past on the arms of some lord in waiting, the unknown skater came to a standstill. She was not a hand's breadth off. She was a woman. Orlando stared, trembled, turned hot, turned cold, longed to hurl himself through the summer air, to crush acorns beneath his feet, to toss his arms with the beech trees and the oaks. As it was, he drew his lips up over his small white teeth, opened them perhaps a half inch as if to bite, shut them as if he had been bitten. The lady Euphrosyne hung upon his arm. Love that image of the biting. It's the most sensuous of all the images, isn't it? And this is the Russian princess, played by Virginia's niece, Angelica's daughter, Vanessa Bell. Photographed by them, of course, for fun. I don't think it looks anything like a Russian princess. I'm sorry about that, but these are one of the illustrations she included in the book. Factually, this passage is based on Vita's visit in the winter of 1927 to Moscow, where the river was frozen over. And the memory this had prompted in Virginia of her favourite work by one of the best of the Elizabethan prose writers, Thomas Dekker, The Great Frost or Cold Doings in London, except it be at the lottery. Apparently everybody was rather hot at the lottery, but the cold doings in London. Dekker gives in it a vivid account of that legendary winter in which the Thames apparently really froze over for a considerable amount of time and the court moved out onto it to create a kind of winter wonderland where the citizens of London could entertain themselves as they walked miraculously on the frozen waters. And Orlando's mistaking of Sasha for a boy, initially the first of the novel's repeated sexual mistakings, is based on an actual incident when Leonard and Virginia went to visit her and she dressed her son up as a Russian boy. And he said, don't. It makes me look like a little girl. interesting, isn't it, that that's the first of the sexual mistakings. And Virginia herself links Orlando's infatuation with Sasha, the Russian princess, and the consummation of their love, very tactfully done, off stage, with Vita's passionate affair with Violet Trefusis when they had fled to Europe. And she had disguised herself as a man and called herself Julia. I'd love to know more about that. The parallels with Vita's life continue throughout Orlando and are far too many to list here. But the real achievement of this so-called biography, as it's subtitled, is in the writing itself. It's often highly satiric, and you might already have noticed that, frequently about the art of biography itself. And just the fact that she gives you illustrations of the actual person, and yet they turn out to be spoof ones, I think, encourages you to realize that this is indeed using biography, but subverting biography. In it also, Vita, as Orlando, is endlessly composing a poem called The Oak Tree, which is a reference to a long poem Vita spent years writing called The Land, published by the Hogarth Press in 1928 and awarded the Hawthornden Prize. Her daring, her gallantry, her beauty, and her charm are all summed up in Orlando's person. He's a very gallant young man. Above all, and however incredible the situation around the main character becomes, we're swept along, I think, by that style. That passage on the ice is a lovely example. Just take that passage. Despite its satiric jibes at the foreign measures that they're dancing, the king shuffling past on the arm of a nobleman, Wolf also convinces us of a passion so intense between Orlando and Sasha that it almost defies description. Passages of great lyrical beauty. The setting itself gives us the first hint of what is to come. By placing Orlando's meeting with Sasha on a frozen river, which could thaw at any time, there's a lovely sense of danger there, isn't there? We are being prepared for one of the main themes of the novel, the idea of permanence versus transience. Of course, the home continues through the ages, but the ages change rapidly as we go through. The ageless Orlando and her solid, unchanging ancestral home are placed then in constant juxtaposition to the centuries through which they rush. Similarly, Orlando and Sasha's love, we eventually realize, is so intense that it cannot survive. Does it? Do you think it burns through the ice? It ends with the ice thawing, of course, in a passage of great, great intensity. So intense that it cannot survive the ordinary world. But this momentary suspension of them both in a dramatic space where people live on ice rather than land allows Orlando, in his eyes at least, a freedom of action. At any other time, in any other place, maybe he would have acted more responsibly, as though the normal constraints do not apply. Ostensibly engaged to be married to the lady Euphrosyne, as the last line implies, this inversion encourages him to behave recklessly. I don't know if you've experienced that when you're in a different place, perhaps a different country. I know you're not going to confess. And it does, in this case anyway, it allows him to escape the everyday world. The ice, which has become a pleasure ground, becomes a metaphor for Orlando's relationship with Sasha, ecstatic but impermanent, existing within a brief time span, conditioned by the extraordinary nature of the background through which it's played out. And later, the violent disruption of the ice will be at the moment of the dissolution of Orlando's hopes, mirrored, therefore, in the ice melting. And, of course, bringing calamity to all those who had assumed that the ice would be permanent. Central to this passage that I've just read, also, as it is central to the whole novel, is the idea of the artificial construct of gender, which is very interesting and, of course, interested the American lesbians very much indeed, because so many people who themselves have had problems in society with their gender are very interested in this idea that we define people so artificially as male or female. The artificial nature of gender becomes quite apparent as, first of all, as she approaches him, he thinks it's a boy. Sexual ambiguity, of course, at the center of the passage. A figure which, whether boys or women's, do you remember this? For the loose tunic and trousers of the Russian fashion served to disguise the sex, filled him with the highest curiosity. The person, whatever the name or sex. And then, of course, his terrible disappointment when he realizes it must be a boy because no woman, talk about prejudice, no woman can skate that fast. And he approaches and then, thank God, you see those breasts again? Thank God she's a woman. No boy had breasts like that. And then that wonderful stylistic, I suppose, climax really when he says, she was a woman. I mean, stylistically, I think that fits in beautifully. The exotic nature of the scene and of the Muscovite Sasha is heightened by the unlikely but suggestive imagery that comes to mind. And I hope you enjoyed them as much as I did. I don't know how many women here would be flattered to be compared to a melon. I'm not sure I would, but you know what he means. He's thinking of all his favourite things, isn't he? The most interesting one is the fox, the white fox. And those lifted teeth ready to bite at the end are very suggestive, aren't they? It's interesting because later on, and this is another way in which he unifies the novel, he brings back that image of the fox. He has called her name, if you want to hear it, is the Princess Marusha Stanislavska Dagmar Natasha Ilyana Romanovich. Poor man had to shorten that one. Sasha for short. And because it was the name of a white Russian fox he'd had as a boy, a creature soft as snow but with teeth of steel, which bit him so savagely that his father had it killed, then Sasha, of course, when we know that, becomes a dangerous person. And Sasha, at the end, goes off with the Russian... Well, his last vision of Sasha is sitting on the knee of a Russian sailor. Jealousy being another theme that runs through Orlando and helps to unify it. It certainly ran through Virginia's relationship with Vita. You remember the reference, the double reference to Campbell, Mary Campbell. The Elizabethan period ends after Orlando has been tormented by that glimpse of Sasha as the ship goes back to Russia. The two subsequent centuries Orlando passes through are also illustrated and to some extent symbolized by their literature, the Elizabethan period, I should have said, ends with a performance of Othello, which of course is a play about jealousy, appropriately. And so she keeps trying to characterize the age by the kind of literature you will encounter. In the 17th century, which quickly follows, Orlando is poring over the funerary meditations of Sir Thomas Browne. And at the end of this period, the 17th century, Orlando abandons his life as a lover and a poet and goes as British ambassador to Constantinople. Well, that's not her as a British ambassador to Constantinople, but that is the Archduchess Harriet, whom she meets when she goes abroad. Mary, 4th Countess of Dorset. And of course, this turns out to be a man. You would expect it, wouldn't you? And after she married her diplomat husband, Harold Nicholson, of course, she had gone to Constantinople. So Vita has to go to Constantinople. And this one is Orlando as ambassador, this is entitled. And this is another of her ancestors, Lionel Sackville, 7th Earl and 1st Duke of Dorset. So all the time, the illustrations are supposedly reinforcing a fiction that this is really Orlando. But the 19th century is best represented by its weather, because in the 18th she's turned into a woman, and that of course is Peter Sackville West pretending to be an 18th century woman, not very successfully in my opinion. And here is Orlando. I think Orlando is supposed to be on her return to England when she comes back into the 18th century. So this is the one she gives you for that. There are passing references to the poetry of the age, Byron, Wordsworth. But the most amusing way in which she does it, characterizes her century here, is with the weather. I don't know whether you remember this wonderful passage where she describes the 19th century. Now, most of us think of the 19th century as a rather heavy age, don't we? Do you remember the drapes that they used to put over all the furniture? Apparently, it was very bad if you exposed the feet of furniture. So you had to cover them. And now this really is serious. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. But what is so lovely and so witty is the way in which it sums up all we feel about the 19th century, or all I feel about the 19th century, in terms of its weather. And of course, some of you will have experienced English weather. Don't get me started on the subject. Having just left an island which is probably frozen over by now, actually, come to think of it. The great cloud, this is number 4 on your sheet. The great cloud which hung, well, in the 19th century now, which hung over, this is the passage which Julia Briggs describes as the place where ivies and babies proliferate. And it's much longer than this, I'm not reading you the whole lot. The great cloud which hung not only over London, but over the whole of the British Isles on the first day of the 19th century, stayed, or rather did not stay, for it was buffeted about constantly by blustering gales, long enough to have extraordinary consequences upon those who lived beneath its shadow. A change seemed to have come over the climate of England. Rain fell frequently, but only in fitful gusts, which were no sooner over than they began again. The sun shone, of course, but it was so girt about with clouds and the air so saturated with water that its beams were discoloured and purple. Oranges and reds of a dull sort took the place of the more positive landscapes of the 18th century. Under this bruised and sullen canopy, the green of the cabbages was less intense and the white of the snow was muddied. But what was worse, damp now began to make its way into every house. Damp, which is the most insidious of all enemies, for while the sun can be shut out by blinds and the frost roasted by a hot fire, damp steals in while we sleep. Damp is silent, imperceptible, ubiquitous. Damp swells the wood, furs the kettle, rusts the iron, rots the stone. So gradual is the process. But it is not until we pick up some chest of drawers or coal scuttle and the whole thing drops to pieces in our hands that we suspect even that the disease is at work. Thus, stealthily and imperceptibly, none marking the exact day or hour of the change, the constitution of England was altered and nobody knew it. Everywhere the effects were felt. The hardy country gentleman who had sat down gladly to a meal of ale and beef in a room designed perhaps by the brothers Adam with classic dignity, now felt chilly. Rugs appeared, beards were grown, trousers were fastened tight under the instep. The chill which he felt in his legs, the country gentleman soon transferred to his house. Furniture was muffled, walls and tables were covered, nothing was left bare. Then a change of diet became essential. The muffin was invented, and the crumpet. Coffee supplanted the after-dinner port. And as coffee led to a drawing room in which to drink it, and a drawing room to glass cases, and glass cases to artificial flowers, and artificial flowers to mantelpieces, and mantelpieces to pianofortes, and pianofortes to drawing room ballads, and drawing room ballads, skipping a stage or two, to innumerable little dogs, mats, and china ornaments, that home, which had become extremely important, was completely altered. And I'd love to read with her passage. Can't just this last little bit so that you don't think she's neglected the outside. Outside the house, it was another effect of the damp. Ivy grew in unparalleled profusion. Isn't it a witty way, don't you think, of describing a change of atmosphere in the age? It is a heavier age. The 18th century is all lightness and elegance, but this one is so beautifully embodied. And the other favourite passage, which is extract 5, about the 19th century, and this happens every period that she deals with, how do you talk about an age, is a surrealist passage. Hermione Lee is wonderful on this passage. She says that it is a great Victorian collection, this edifice that we're going to read about. The Albert Memorial, as invented by Lewis Carroll's White Knight. Lovely, isn't it? It's so surreal. Because she's imagining an ornament, a monument, all the things that are brought together to sum up, symbolise the Victorian age. And it brings in all little bits of history, like Victoria being a widow for many years and wearing widow's weeds. A pyramid, hecatomb, or trophy, for it had something of a banquet table air. A conglomeration, at any rate, of the most heterogeneous and ill-assorted objects piled higgledy-piggledy in a vast mound where the statue of Queen Victoria now stands. Draped about a vast cross of fretted and floriated gold were widow's weeds and bridal veils. Hooked onto the other excrescences were crystal palaces, bassinets, military helmets, memorial wreaths, trousers, whiskers, wedding cakes, cannon, Christmas trees. They came in the 19th century too, apparently. So what she's doing, of course, is she's summing up all the things that came into England and English cultural life in the 19th century. Telescopes, extinct monsters, globes, maps, elephants, and mathematical instruments. The whole supported like a gigantic coat of arms on the right side by a female figure clothed in flowing white. On the left by a portly gentleman wearing a frock coat and sponge bag trousers. The incongruity of the objects, the association of the fully clothed and partly draped, the garishness of the different colours and their plaid-like juxtaposition afflicted Orlando with the most profound dismay. She had never in all her life seen anything at once so indecent, so hideous and so monumental. You can tell she's not really terribly keen on the 19th century. Hermione Lee describes then this as a surreal picture, a Lewis Carroll sort of picture. But it also serves a serious purpose, and it also serves to remind us that what was begun as a joke actually turns into an attempt to characterise the different periods of English literature. Leonard Woolf preferred to think of Virginia's book as a satire. He took it more seriously than she did. It is a satire. It apes the conventions of traditional biography, for example, quite consciously having an acknowledgement. It has an index, every biographer's nightmare, and so-called family photographs. I don't think you've seen all of them. That's Shelmerdine. You know Shelmerdine? The lover. The 19th century lover who becomes the husband and who may be a woman and who may be a man. And the photographs and Orlando in the present day, dressed as a woman, because of course Orlando turns into a woman in the 20th century. It has all of these trappings of a biography, but Leonard saw it therefore as, although Virginia said it was half laughing, half serious, he saw the serious part of it. The fact that it does deal with a great, great many of those themes that are so important as we go through the book. Love, jealousy, memory, the writing process, because of course she talks about how difficult Orlando finds it to write. Life itself, with of course a pun on Vita's name, Vita, life, in Italian or Latin. Time and its relativity, the way the centuries rush past. Gender, and the uncertainty of its boundaries, the subversion of time and sex, prudery, when we get to the 19th century, marriage, she's got to get married in the 19th century because the marriage in the 19th century was absolutely essential, fear of infidelity and abandonment, fear of age and death. And all these things come in a way that makes it really quite a serious book when you look at it more carefully. It's equally ambitious and successful in other directions. It's sweep through English literature in varying styles, appropriate to the age, is very clever indeed. It gives us a sense of history and of London. Do you remember as she comes back in the 18th century, she sees that Wren, or is it 17th century, she sees that Mr. Wren has built St. Paul's Cathedral and the skyline of London has changed. All these things are done so very skillfully that we hardly notice them. And she's been told when she comes back in the 17th century, there had been a plague and a fire in her absence. And contrary to all Virginia's fears, Orlando proved tremendously popular with the general public. I'm always surprised at that, you know. I didn't think the general public was quite so sophisticated. I think you're very sophisticated to come to a talk on Orlando. It's not an easy book. But the general public actually liked it. It sold in its first 6 months. Now, how many? It sold a great, yes, it sold over 8,000 copies in its first 6 months alone, which for those days was very good. More than twice what her previous novel, To the Lighthouse, had sold in a year. So the general public was not as unsophisticated as she had imagined, and it really established her name as a writer. Vita's son, Nigel Nicholson, has called Orlando the most charming love letter in literature. And it is certainly that. By the time it was published in 1928, October 1928, which is the day the book closes, the affair was over and Vita had gone her merry way onto a string of other lovers. But in a sense, the affair was never over. Because Vita has been immortalized for all time in the biography of Orlando, giving her back to Noel in the book, as she was not given Noel in her life, because in her life she was not allowed to inherit Noel, though she was the only child of Lord Sackville West. It was handed to a cousin, Rebecca West, who was no relation, but who was a very good gifted novelist herself, proclaimed Orlando a poetic masterpiece, and I think that's how we should best see it. Thank you.